It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out how a Kennedy daughter ended up spending the last decades of her life in an institution in Wisconsin.
First, the chief of staff at the Toma VA Medical Center has been fired. Dr. David Houlihan was let go after the VA investigated his clinical practices and his alleged retaliatory behavior towards whistleblowers. According to reports, some veterans refer to him as the candy man for his practice of liberally prescribing painkillers.
Houlihan had been on leave since January while the Department of Veterans Affairs investigated accusations of overprescribing narcotic pain medications. Joining us now is Donovan Slack, reporter at USA Today's Washington Bureau. She's been following this story. Donovan, welcome back to the show.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So was there an explanation of what specific reasons Dr. Houlihan was fired?
Well, they're not really saying outright, as you said. Basically, they're saying that after investigations of his clinical practices and his retaliatory behavior against subordinates, they decided to relieve him of his duties. But they didn't say specifically what they found.
Well, take us back to the beginning. Why did the Toma VA Medical Center come under fire in the first place?
Right. Well, this all kind of blew open in January, where a report from the Center for Investigative Reporting really outlined Chief of Staff Houlihan's practices at the medical center. And as you said, he was nicknamed the candy man among veterans because of his propensity to prescribe very high amounts of opiates. And subsequent investigations by the VA internally did find that to be the case. In fact, one found that veteran patients at the Toma VA were 2.5 times more likely to get these incredibly high doses of opiates than anywhere else.
And ultimately, there was a death linked to these prescriptions mixed with other prescription medications.
Absolutely. A Marine Corps veteran from Stevens Point named Jason Simkuski actually died from a fatal mixture of drugs at the Toma VA in August 2014.
It's been a slow process getting this out into the public. There were whistleblowers. Who was trying to get the word out? What kind of response did they get?
Well, there's all kinds of whistleblowers. The main one in this case is a gentleman by the name of Ryan Honel, who started speaking out about this last fall, and he helped the Center for Investigative Reporting really get to the bottom of what was happening here. And you're right, it has been quite a long time, if you consider it's November, and they just announced last Friday that they are taking action against the chief of staff.
We're talking to Donovan Slack, reporter for USA Today, looking at the Toma VA story. A key doctor, Dr. David Houlihan, just announced that he is being let go from that facility linked to the activities there. Now, this is, in effect, a workplace action, Donovan. Is there talk of professional bodies taking action against Dr. Houlihan or even legal proceedings?
Well, this is what's interesting. There's a little bit of a black hole here because Dr. Houlihan was under investigation by state officials there in January. It's unclear what that investigation found. I was just trying to figure it out before coming on air, and I can't seem to figure it out. So I'm guessing that is either still ongoing or has been resolved without action against him.
Lawmakers from Wisconsin have reacted to this news. What kind of things have we heard from senators and our congressional delegation?
Well, on several fronts, I think Senator Tammy Baldwin introduced a bill named after the Simkuski Marine, and it would overhaul opiate prescription policies throughout the VA. I know Senator Johnson has proposed a bill that would require the VA to release secret reports. There was a report on this institution, but it wasn't released publicly until this year. And that would require that they release all the reports going forward. Representative Ron Kind has introduced a bill. I think it would do something similar. So everybody's really trying to push for action here. Right now, all of that legislation does not appear to be moving forward yet.
We have this new firing. The Toma VA had let its director go a couple months back. So where does the center go from here? What's actually happening, apart from getting rid of these leading officials, what's happening to change treatment at that facility?
Right. Well, from the VA central office here in Washington, they rolled out something called an opioid safety tool. And that would be used across the nation in real time for doctors at VA facilities to see exactly how many drugs and how much of each veteran is being prescribed. And if it reaches a certain dangerous level, it would notify them and they could correct it. On the local level, as you said there, the director of the facility has been removed. Now Dr. Houlihan has been removed. There was one other practitioner removed. And just recently, they appointed an acting director who will manage the facility going forward.
As a reporter covering this story, do you feel like there's more transparency in this VA facility where the public knows more of what's going on there than we used to?
Oh, absolutely. Do I think that that's a sign of things going forward? I'm not so sure. But I think in this case, when you have huge media attention to a particular facility, you're going to have a lot more transparency about what's going on there.
Is there any sign that the veterans who use that facility are not getting those higher doses of opiate medications that could have been putting them in danger?
At this point, we don't really know. We only have the VA's assurances that it has, you know, installed this new tool and will be using it going forward. At this point, we don't have any new reports of deaths based on opiates.
So this is not the end of the story. Are we going to be seeing more changes in TOMA as a result of these ongoing investigations?
I think you will. I think it's already been almost a year. I think this will keep going for another few months.
Donovan, thanks as always for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
That was USA Today reporter Donovan Slack giving us the latest on the firing of a doctor at the center of the Toma VA Medical Center scandal.
Much has been written about the Kennedy clan, a family full of successful business people and politicians who also rubbed elbows with some of the biggest celebrities of their time.
But the ambitious and driven family with nine children had a closely guarded secret. The oldest girl, Rosemary, was born with serious disabilities. In that era, physical and emotional disabilities were seen as the result of faulty genes or as a punishment of the parents. The medical field had a poor understanding of the causes and few options for treatment.
Rosemary Kennedy lived the last several decades of her life right here in Wisconsin at St. Coletta's School in Jefferson. Joining us to talk about Rosemary and her surprising legacy is author and historian Kate Clifford Larson. Her most recent book is Rosemary, The Hidden Kennedy Daughter. Kate, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So what were the first indications that Rosemary was not like her siblings?
When she was a toddler, it became apparent to her parents that she was slower in her development than her older brothers, Joe and Jack. You know, she had trouble learning how to eat, slower to walk and talk and use a bicycle and things like that. So they recognized that there was something different. And when the next two children, Rosemary's younger sisters, Kathleen, Kick, and Eunice were born, and they, you know, went right through their developmental changes at what were expected times, they realized that Rosemary was significantly delayed and that there was a problem.
So Rosemary was born in 1918. How would you describe the societal attitudes about people with physical and mental disabilities at that time?
It was not very good, that's for sure. We live in an entirely different world now. But in 1918 and the 1920s, when Rosemary was growing up as a young child in school, there were few resources for her. The teachers were at a loss as to how to help educate her and, you know, help her improve her skills. And in society in general, there were very unsophisticated ideas about what intellectual disabilities were, and they had horrible names for people who had lower IQs, which Rosemary did have a lower IQ, and so there were these terrible terms like imbecile and moron, and it was just horrifying to think about the ways they treated and thought about people with disabilities, and many of them were put away in institutions, locked away from their families and communities because no one wanted to deal with them.
So Joe and Rose were the parents of the Kennedy clan, and they were in a difficult position. They had instilled ambition and a very strong sense of competitive nature in their children, but clearly Rosemary couldn't keep up. And in addition, they were worried that her condition would reflect badly on them and especially on their aspirations for their sons. How would you describe their attempts to manage her condition?
Early on, they didn't really manage it so much as they sought ways to cure her. And, of course, we all know that you can't cure someone who has intellectual disabilities. So they sent her to many different schools and different doctors looking for solutions to what they believed was something that could be cured if Rosemary just had the right teacher or the right doctor or the right medication. And if she would just buckle down and study hard, then she could be as talented and bright as her siblings. And as she got older, that's when it became more of a problem for Joe and Rose, because their boys were getting older, excuse me, and they were, you know, their aspirations were becoming apparent. The parents wanted them to be successful, and to have Rosemary acting out and of limited intellectual capacity just didn't fit the image they wanted everyone to see of their family. So they tried to find ways to hide her.
It's also interesting that they were already dealing with feeling like outsiders and being somewhat marginalized because they were Catholic, and they were trying to make names for themselves and establish themselves in that very Protestant North New England kind of area.
Absolutely. They definitely lived with prejudice against Irish Catholics. And Joe was very smart and very successful, but he ran into those old line Protestant successful families who would not accept, you know, the new upstart Irish financier and bright guy on the block, and they refused him access to their clubs, and it infuriated him, and he wanted to be sure that his sons would never be shunned, that they would never be turned away. And having Rosemary with her issues posed another problem for them, because they feared that that would help limit the sons' access to the higher echelons of society.
We're talking with author and historian Kate Clifford Larson. Her most recent book is Rosemary, the Hidden Kennedy Daughter. And one thing that I found really interesting was that Rose Kennedy, Rosemary's mother, actually was ahead of her time in at least one area. She was trying to, what we now say, mainstream Rosemary and keep her in classes with people who were her chronological age, not necessarily her developmental age.
That's true. So I sort of give Rose some credit for trying to do that. However, there was a tremendous gap between what Rose desired for her daughter and sought for her daughter and what the teachers and schools were able to provide. And so today, of course, Rosemary would be mainstreamed in classrooms. But back in the 1920s and 1930s, that was not possible. And Rosemary just fell further and further behind her classmates. She was kept back grades several times so that she just didn't fit in anymore. And she started acting out because she became very frustrated by not being able to keep up with her peers. And so the teachers just didn't know how to deal with her. So it just led to a series of inappropriate educational placements for Rosemary.
So she did start to regress and to have those frequent violent outbursts in her early 20s. And tragically for her, that was when lobotomies emerged as a form of treatment. Tell us about the decision to perform that operation on Rosemary.
This is such a tragic decision that Joe Kennedy made. They had returned from England after he had been ambassador there just as on the eve of World War II. And Rosemary had blossomed in England with the Assumption School that she went to, and she had been taught with the Montessori method. So her outbursts had come less often, but they came back to the United States and they couldn't find an appropriate place for her. And she started acting out and escaping from the convent school that they had put her in as a 23-year-old woman. She was escaping at night, and they imagined she was with young men and doing heaven knows what. So Joe heard of this new procedure called the lobotomy being performed in Washington, D.C., where Rosemary was at a convent school. And James Watts and Walter Freeman had performed fewer than 100 lobotomies at the time that they performed the operation on Rosemary. And the American Medical Association warned against the surgery. They said it wasn't perfected yet, that it was just an experiment. But Joe went ahead and had had his daughter subjected to it, which is very puzzling that he would do this to her considering how experimental the surgery was. And, of course, the surgery was a horrific disaster. And it's a deep question about whether Rose knew or not. And I discovered that she did know that Joe was inquiring about a lobotomy. She said she had no idea that the lobotomy had taken place. That is not true. She did know that it happened. Whether or not she agreed to it, we're not really sure. But the tragedy is she never saw her daughter for 20 years after that. And that is just remarkable to me.
So Rosemary ended up at the St. Coletta School in Jefferson, Wisconsin, where she spent more than 50 years until her death in 2005. Tell us about St. Coletta's and the kind of life that she had there.
I think that her life at St. Coletta's was really wonderful. It was nurturing and safe, and she also blossomed in a sense that she became healthier. She had a lot of physical therapy. She had very patient nuns that worked with her. She acquired more speech than she had before. She had been at another institution for several years after the lobotomy, and she couldn't walk or talk or do anything. But at St. Coletta, she learned all those things, and the nuns really loved her and took care of her, and she grew to be very comfortable and very happy there. In fact, when she eventually started visiting her family again in the 1970s, it was quite traumatic for her to leave St. Coletta's, where she was comfortable and she had friends and people that loved and cared for her, to go back to her strange home. And they were often very tense and a rocky time for her.
And while she clearly had serious disabilities, in her younger life, she was very well liked. She enjoyed social outings. She would go to dances with her brother Jack, who became President John F. Kennedy. But after this lobotomy, she was just a shell of her former self.
Right. She was a shell of her former self. However, she still was cognizant, even though she couldn't really communicate very well. She knew her siblings. She knew enough to know that she had been abandoned by her mother, and that this terrible thing had happened to her. So she did have that anger and frustration that remained a part of her life. But growing up and as a young woman, she was beautiful, she was happy, she was immature, certainly for her age, but she, you know, was just a delightful, delightful person, and it's such a tragedy that with all the money that the Kennedys had, that Joe decided to do this operation rather than find another placement for her that would have made her life a lot better.
Well, and you mentioned her siblings, and Rosemary was very much a part of the family life for the first couple decades of her life, but then she was shipped away after the botched operation, and for many years, none of her siblings pressed their parents about details of where she was and what she was doing. How do you make sense of that?
I can't make sense of it. But Eunice Shriver spoke about that. Timothy Shriver, in his book last year, wrote about that his mother and his aunts and uncles had said that they had no idea where Rosemary went, what had happened to her, and they had learned not to ask. And I find that shocking, but knowing Joe and Rose and how powerful and controlling they were, I can imagine that those kids had learned not to rock the boat, and they did what their parents told them. As a matter of fact, Senator Ted Kennedy wrote in his memoir that he was 9 years old when Rosemary was lobotomized and disappeared from the family, and he said that he had learned that he'd better behave or he might disappear like Rosemary too.
So brother Teddy Kennedy and sister Eunice Kennedy Shriver both credit Rosemary with inspiring them to work to improve the lives of people with disabilities. In concrete terms, what can we point to as Rosemary's legacy?
Oh, my goodness, so much. Not only Special Olympics, which is a worldwide organization to bring sports and activities and research and everything for people with disabilities and their families, but so much legislation has been passed since President Kennedy was in office right through to the present day. The Americans with Disabilities Act was passed because of efforts of Senator Ted Kennedy and others. Much legislation has come out of this passion for correcting the wrongs were in the world when Rosemary was a child. Eunice was deeply affected by the way Rosemary was treated as a young child and young woman, the rejection and the pain and anguish. And I think that Eunice continued till the day she died to try to make it a better world for everybody. Same with Senator Ted Kennedy and Sister Jean Kennedy Smith, all of them, and the younger generations as well. Anthony Shriver with his Best Buddies program. Timothy Shriver is now running Special Olympics. They all are living the legacy of Rosemary. She had a tremendously powerful impact on the family, and we are a better nation because of it.
Well, Kate Clifford Larson, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a really fascinating book and a fascinating discussion.
Thank you very much for having me.
Kate Clifford Larson is a historian. Her most recent book is Rosemary, The Hidden Kennedy Daughter. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The 2015 United Nations Climate Change Conference is slated to begin at the end of the month in Paris. The goal is to reach a legally binding agreement from all nations of the world to address climate change.
The conference comes at the end of a year that's on track to be the hottest yet. Leaders from around the globe have already made commitments on their own to cut carbon emissions. And this year, the Pope released an unprecedented encyclical dedicated to combating climate change.
Here with us now is Tim Flannery. He is Australia's former chief climate commissioner, and he's the author of the new book, Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. Tim, thanks for joining us today.
It's a great pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
About a decade ago, you published the book, The Weathermakers. It drew public attention to this issue, climate change, back then not as widely acknowledged as it is today. How have perceptions of climate change changed in the intervening years?
Well, you know, I remember a decade ago when I was traveling around the U.S. and indeed the world talking about climate change. I had to show a series of graphs, you know, scientific graphs of CO2 rising and that sort of thing. I don't have to do that anymore because most people now know climate change from direct lived experience. Wherever I go, people know that the heat waves and the megafires and the changes they're seeing in their climate are related to this increased burden of greenhouse gases. So that's a great step forward, actually. It gives us a firm foundation for action when the community basically knows what's happening.
And that's a point you make right off the bat in your book, that we're not talking about a hypothetical thing 50 years from now. We're living in a climate-changing world right now.
We certainly are. And, you know, people in the U.S. know this as well as anybody. You know, on the East Coast, up in the New England area, you've had a huge increase in rainfall intensity. So, you know, rain that used to fall gently and over a longer time now falls in big clumped masses, and it tends to overwhelm drainage infrastructure, sewers and so forth. In the southwest, you've had historic droughts, things that have never been seen the likes of in the 500 years that Europeans have been living in that area. And, of course, up in the north and in other areas, forested areas, you've seen huge forest fires. So there are big, large-scale changes right across the country, really, which people now, I think, understand the origins of.
People say, though, hey, look, in the winter we still have snow, and with these extreme events you're talking about, it's hard to draw a direct line saying this specific event was caused by climate change. Is it hard to overcome those perceptions?
There's still a small group of people. In Australia, it's about 6 or 7% of the population who just reject all evidence. And they're the sort of people who will never change their mind anyway, no matter what evidence you put before them. But the rest of the community is more thoughtful than that. And, you know, the science has advanced as well. It used to be the case that we didn't have a method that allowed us to slate home responsibility for a single weather event to the greenhouse gases, the human greenhouse gases. But that's changed. You know, last year in Australia, we have a thing called the Australian Tennis Open. It's in my home city of Melbourne. And we had to cancel play at that Open a year ago because 1,000 spectators had to be treated for heat stress. It was above 50 degrees in the main stadium, and these were unprecedented conditions.
That's Celsius.
Scientists did an analysis. Yeah, Celsius, that's right. It's very hot. So scientists did an analysis of the weather patterns at that time, and they did a series of computer runs saying, would this have ever happened without the human-caused greenhouse gases? And it turns out the chances were about 1 in 12,000 that it would happen naturally. It was much, much more likely to happen when you add in the influence of the human-caused greenhouse gases. So the science is now, at least in some circumstances, allowing us to say, well, this definitely would not have happened without the human impact on the climate system.
How about efforts to tackle this problem? What do you make of what national leaders, international leaders have done in the 10 years since your previous book came out?
Well, for 8 of those years, I was pretty depressed. You know, I played a role at Copenhagen. I was chairing the Copenhagen Climate Council for 3 years, and we really hoped for better out of that first meeting. But to be honest with you, for the last decade, the world has been on the worst-case scenario emissions trajectory for greenhouse gases. So it's as bad as anyone could have imagined it would have been. Things are just starting to change. You know, in the lead-up to Paris now, we've seen governments commit unilaterally to reduce emissions, and it looks like the Paris meeting will get us off that worst-case scenario trajectory where we were heading for 4 degrees of warming by the end of the century onto a trajectory that's closer to 2.7 degrees of warming by 2100. Now, that's still way, way too warm, but at least we are starting to see now the beginnings of change, I think.
Talking to Tim Flannery about his new book, Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. Well, most of your book, Tim, focuses on solutions. Let's get to that now. First, you mentioned cutting emissions. That seems to be a starting point. In this upcoming conference, end of this month into December, do you think there will be solid commitments that actually make a difference in carbon and other greenhouse gas emissions?
Look, I do think so. You know, we have tried and failed to have a legally binding treaty, a top-down approach, and I was never that keen on them anyway, to be honest with you. You know, we saw with the Kyoto Protocol that Canada didn't live up to its obligations and should have paid $1 billion in fines, but there was no blue helmet seen north of the border there in Canada to try to get the money back. You know, the enforcement for these legal treaties isn't great. But if nations set their own targets, it looks pretty bad when you fail a test that you've set yourself, you know? And so there is hope, I think, that these targets will be honoured. Countries have set them with full knowledge of their economy and how they work, and they're going into this meeting with goodwill, bolstered by the view that other people are doing similar things and that this can all be achieved.
Is that going to be enough? If countries set those legally binding emissions agreements, is it going to do enough to keep those carbon levels down to an acceptable level?
Well, look, the sad fact is that there's enough greenhouse gas already in the air to raise global temperatures to 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average. And at those sort of levels, you know, the Great Barrier Reef just won't survive. It won't be there. So we're dealing with this very, very late. You know, as I said, the cumulative emissions will keep temperatures around below 2.7 degrees. We really need to be below 2 degrees if we want to have a stable climate future. So we need other tools, and that's what my book's really about, outlining these other tools, the third-way technologies that can draw CO2 out of the atmosphere at scale.
And let's get into that now. There's a lot of things I hadn't heard of before I read the book, Tim. These third way ideas to get, as you say, the carbon out of the atmosphere. One is taking a common mineral, olivine, I don't know how to pronounce it, and using it for lots of things. Tell us about that. Oop, we've lost Tim Flannery. We're talking to Tim Flannery about solutions to climate change. He's the author of the new book, Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. He's Australia's former chief climate commissioner. This all comes on the eve of a major international conference hosted by the UN, trying to get specific emissions commitments from every country on Earth, if possible, to cut emissions. In just a few moments, we'll talk to Tim about ideas, alternatives to solve the problem.
And we'll continue the conversation, maybe hearing from you when you call 800-642-1234. Do you think the United States is taking appropriate action to combat climate change? Should we do more? Should we do less? What do you think about the prospect of a universal agreement on climate change? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with Tim Flannery, Australia's former Chief Climate Commissioner and author of the new book, Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. At the end of the month, all members of the United Nations will meet to try to reach a legally binding agreement on climate change for every country on Earth.
We'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about climate change? What do you think about the idea of geoengineering the planet to stem climate change, or we're going to talk about now capturing carbon from the air? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Tim, talk about this idea of capturing carbon and maybe even using it.
Well, I was skeptical initially of the possibility of capturing carbon at a significantly large scale and then putting it somewhere or using it that we could affect the climate system. But I've become involved with a thing called the Virgin Earth Challenge, which is a £25 million prize that Richard Branson has put up to foster technologies that can do precisely that. And there's been 11,000 entries into that prize, and some of them really show astonishing potential. Basically in two streams. You know, one stream is called the biological, and that involves everything from reforestation to the development of biochar and onto seaweed farms, which strangely hold a very large potential. And then the chemical processes, which involve things like carbon-negative concretes, which are very new on the market. They're concretes that absorb CO2, as they said, onto plastics made from atmospheric CO2 or even carbon fibres made from atmospheric carbon dioxide. And there's certain rocks that you can grind up, and as they weather, they will absorb carbon dioxide as well. So there's a huge range of possibilities out there. And my best guess was that by 2050, they could be drawing out about 40% of the current emissions that we put up into the atmosphere every year.
But we'd have to do these things on a really large scale to have them make a difference, wouldn't we?
That's right. We're talking about the gigaton scale here. And just to give you a sense of that, last year we put 40 gigatons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. If you wanted to take one-tenth of that out, so 4 gigatons out, using reforestation or tree planting, for example, you'd need to plant forests over an area the size of Australia, which is almost as big as the contiguous 48 states of the USA. And that would give you that 4 gigatons on average. But, you know, you think about the scale of that. Clearly, reforestation can do a small bit of the job, but we've got to find other tools that can also do something.
Let's go to one of our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jeremy is on the line in Milwaukee. Jeremy, hi.
Hi. For one, the geoengineering thing, I'm a truck driver, and I watch them spraying this stuff all day long, every day. That's not helping anything. In my opinion, it's making things worse.
I'm sorry, Jeremy, spraying?
Spraying what? I don't know what they're spraying up there, but they're spraying something. And I can, you know, and when I was younger, you didn't see these trails going all the way across the sky from horizon to horizon.
Jeremy, I think Jeremy may be confusing those airplane vapor trails, but he's not wrong. There has been talk, Tim, of adding things like, I think, sulfur into the atmosphere to try to reduce greenhouse gases. You're not a fan of that idea, right?
That's right. And one idea is you mix a bit of sulfur in jet fuel, and you can dull the Earth's atmosphere, and therefore a lot of light will get reflected back into space. I think they're dangerous ideas because they don't deal with the underlying problem of the overabundance of CO2, which is acidifying our oceans and causing other changes. And they're really like a Band-Aid solution on a very festering wound, you know. And once you take the Band-Aid off or it pops off, you can have very dramatic change. And, you know, if for some reason sulfur wasn't continued to be sprayed, we could have the climate system rebound and react in very odd ways. So I think basically they're a bad idea. But I do think that the slower third-way technologies, even though they're slower, are better in the longer term because they help strengthen Earth's own system of self-regulation. You know, they either mimic the way the natural system draws CO2 out or enhance that. And that's a fundamentally sound way to go about dealing with the problem, I think. The difficulty is, of course, that many of these technologies are at a very nascent stage, a very, very early stage of development, and it's going to be 10, 20, 30 years before the scale that we need.
But you make the case in your book that technology can improve quickly if we start trying it now. So you're hoping to see a lot of at least pilot projects in this third-way carbon capture technology?
Indeed, and I think there's a huge opportunity there because these technologies are so broad-based across the economy that they're going to have massive impacts. And, you know, we've already seen a number of booms. We're seeing the tech boom, the clean tech boom, and, you know, they've propelled economies. And this boom will be bigger than those. And we know that it's going to have to be used because that CO2 is not going to disappear out of the atmosphere of its own accord. We're going to have to work to draw it out. And, of course, some of these technologies will be highly profitable. I mean, making carbon nanofibers from atmospheric CO2 at a fraction of the cost of current production methods, as has just been shown, that's a fantastic technological advance. The country that masters that is going to be competing head-on with steel production and aluminium production for a huge share of the market when it comes to building structures, cars, planes, whatever.
And a lot of these ideas are not hypothetical. You talk about a roofing company, I think it is, in Europe, that is using one of the minerals you mentioned to create a carbon-catching rooftop.
Well, that's right. I mean, the heartening thing is that at a small scale, a lot of these technologies have already been demonstrated. So the Dutch roofing company you're talking about is great. I mean, they take a rock ball serpentinite, which is very common in parts of the Earth's crust, grind it up, mix it with their roof paint, and as it weathers on your roof, it captures carbon dioxide. That's a pretty neat trick. You know, some people are thinking about seeding whole beaches with that crushed up rock so that as the waves go back and forth and the rock erodes, it'll be capturing CO2 at a very large scale. The downside of it is, of course, that we use fossil fuels to crush up, to quarry and crush up rocks currently. We've got to get away from that and find cleaner ways of really powering some of these chemical third-way technologies.
Talking to Tim Flannery, author of the book Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. And Tim, another solution you keyed in on that's being tried, and I want to expand on a little, the idea of using a seaweed to combat climate change, to absorb carbon. What is out there? What stage is that in now?
Well, you know, the funny thing is seaweed is one of those technologies with the greatest potential, but very typically it's the one that's least developed. Seaweed is great stuff because it grows at 30 to 60 times the speed of land-based plants, so it can capture lots of CO2 very quickly. One desktop study suggests that if we could cover 9% of the world's ocean in seaweed farms, you could draw down all of current annual emissions of carbon dioxide and also grow enough fish and other seafood under those seaweed farms to feed, give 200 kilograms of protein to a population of 10 billion every year. And that's because the seaweed buffers the ocean. It makes it less acid and it becomes a very favourable environment for growing oysters and prawns and fish and whatever else. So that's some of that technology is in place. You know, there's 500 square kilometres of seaweed farms off the coast of China now, so we know how they work. The problem is when you're growing seaweed at that scale and you want to capture the carbon out of it, how do you do that? How do we use that seaweed? You know, we don't want piles of seaweed clogging up the world's oceans, but, you know, so we've got to find a way to use that seaweed and then to store the CO2 from it.
I want to get into one more thing on the problem side of things here. Ocean, you just mentioned it, acidification. How big a worry should that be for us as we think about climate change?
Look, to me, that is one of the great sleeping issues. You know, ocean acidification was only really recognized in the early 2000s, and it's only in the last couple of years that scientists have developed methodologies for studying it properly. But it's not a sort of a hypothetical problem. It's a very concrete problem. You can go to parts of the sea floor where there's volcanic vents that are putting CO2 into the atmosphere, and you can see the impacts, and they're pretty catastrophic. They have a very severe impact on a lot of organisms. And we're only now beginning to study the life cycle of organisms to a degree where we understand how big those impacts can be. One example of that was the catastrophic death of oyster spat off the northwest coast of America a few years back that was caused directly by ocean acidification. It cost industry a lot of money. Now, a fix was found for that. But that problem, it's a creeping problem, and it will really damage our oceans, I think, if it's left unaddressed.
I want to dig deeper into your title, Atmosphere of Hope. There seems to be an atmosphere of gloom and doom now. The answer isn't fixing this problem. It's going to happen. We have to figure out how to adapt to it. You are making the case that things are kind of bad, but we're not there yet. We don't have to give up yet.
Well, that's right. I mean, look, the situation is serious. We're committed to 1.5 degrees of warming. We likely can't cut emissions fast enough to avoid 2. But we are making a start on cutting emissions. The Paris meeting is going to be important, and the action of individual people is hugely important. It's amazing what we've achieved, the billions of us working together over the last few years. But on top of that, we now have this new weapon we didn't know about, this third-way technology, which didn't even have a name before I wrote the book. You know, it wasn't really part of consideration. But if it really can draw down 40% of CO2, that's a conservative estimate that we're putting up now, by 2050, it will be a major part of our future. And, you know, 2050 is 35 years away, but think about living in 1915 and what 1950 must have looked like for those people driving their horse and buggies around. They couldn't have imagined a nuclear world or jet aircraft or communism covering half the country. In the same way, 2050 for us is unimaginable. But the potential is there. The technologies are in nascent form, but they're there. So I'm quite optimistic that we can overcome this problem with the right mix of investment in future technologies and driving down the burning of fossil fuel now as hard as we can.
Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's been a great pleasure. Thanks so much.
That's Tim Flannery. He's Australia's former chief climate commissioner. He's the author of the new book. It's called Atmosphere of Hope, Searching for Solutions to the Climate Crisis. We've been looking ahead at an international conference on climate change and carbon emissions that's coming up at the end of this month.
And yes, the United Nations will be meeting in Paris, trying to hammer out a legally binding agreement for all of the nations on Earth.
There's a whole mess of big news for fans of Star Trek, the long-running science fiction franchise. Next year, 50th anniversary of the original show kicking off its mission, and next summer we'll see another movie in the rebooted series with that new cast playing the original Kirk, Spock, and so on.
And CBS announced today that the franchise will return to television as well with a new series, as yet unnamed, hitting the airwaves in January of 2017.
Yeah, there hasn't been a Star Trek TV presence since 2005 when the show Enterprise went off the air, except for lots and lots of syndication.
I was just going to say, you can pretty much find it anytime you want it on some channel somewhere.
Were you a Star Trek observer?
I was not an original series fan, mm-hmm. but I was a big fan of Next Generation. I watched Voyager, and I liked Deep Space Nine, too.
I think I first got into it with Next Generation mm-hmm. in syndication. I remember watching it at midnight with friends.
Yes,
that's where
yes.
I first got hooked on the show. My kids, Next Generation, they liked. Some Deep Space Nine. Voyager, I think they watched, too.
Voyager's pretty awesome with a woman captain, I have to say.
Yeah, that was a good one. So we'll see what the new TV series may hold for the future.